Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley speaking to you from Washington, D.C. And we are now receiving reports of a highly significant event. It could be, if continued, a world-changing event. And we are referring to the offensive against ISIS, which has emerged at the end of last week and indeed at the beginning of this week. And what it amounts to is a series of new offensives. And I guess we're up to four of these offensives. And you have been hearing various defeatists, neocons, crypto Trumpists, whatever, scurrying around telling you that this can't work, but I think it is working. So it is a four-pronged assault on ISIS. I don't think anybody has put this together, at least in the widely viewed cable TV or broadcast TV. And here's how it goes. Last week, you will remember, towards the end of the week, we pointed to the fact that U.S.-backed Kurdish forces, it means the YPG, sometimes these are called the SDF, Syrian Democratic Forces. It's essentially the Syrian Democratic Forces are a U.S.-promoted coalition of armed groups, but the dominant force here are the YPG Kurds, and this is extremely important. They, SDF YPG, we're just going to call it YPG for the sake of economy. They have arrived within 10 or 20 kilometers of Raqqa, which is, of course, the terrorist capital. This is the capital of the caliphate. This is where Caliph Baghdadi, the Caliph of Baghdad, he operates out of there, ostensibly, is now under pressure, at least. And in addition to this, not so far away, we've got this question of Manbij, M-A-N-B-I-J. Look it up. It is a town in the Jarablus corridor. You know that we have been demanding for more than a year and a half, I think, by now, the way to end the Syrian civil war, to destroy ISIS, to break them up as a territorial entity, and to relieve the immigrant pressure on Europe. This was my thesis, for example, in early November of last year in Friedberg, in Hessen, and that was a large crowd. And I said, look, you know, the German Bundeswehr could do this. The U.S. could do it. Russia could do it. Britain, France, Germany, maybe Italy, others could do it. Consortium of smaller NATO states. The Jarablus corridor, both have existed in Western print. You remember, it is a 100-kilometer or 60-mile stretch, which goes from Jarablus on the Euphrates River west across to Azaz and Efrin. And that is the portal through which all ISIS logistics, or virtually all ISIS logistics, must pass. It is where ammunition comes in, food, new recruits, cannon fodder, new fanatics to be fed into the killing machines and the killing fields, spare parts, equipment, whatever it is, anything, the sinews of war in any form have to come in through that corridor. And, of course, the smuggled oil, which is of so much interest to the principal oil smuggler, the son of Erdogan, all of that will out through the Jarablus corridor. So here's what we have. I'm looking at Al Jazeera website. This is a dispatch 15 hours ago, and this now means 3:30 in the afternoon of June 3rd, 2016. Here we find that the SDF, again, under the leadership of the YPG, are about to take Manbij. And here we read, the U.S.-backed coalition aims to cut off the town seen as key ISIL, ISIS, Daesh, Caliphate, Islamic State supply route from Turkey as airstrikes soften up the fighters. And what do we find? Kurdish-led forces have launched an offensive to capture the Syrian town of Manbij, a suspected supply route for the Islamic, also known as ISIS, to smuggle weapons from Turkey. The SDF, a U.S.-backed coalition of armed groups led by the Kurdish YPG, are mobilizing near in the northern part of Aleppo province on Thursday, yesterday, Agence France-Presse reported. There have been 18 coalition airstrikes. And here we have a new pundit, Jennifer Caffarella, Syria analyst for the Institute of the Study of War in Washington. That's Kimberly Kagan and company, General Keane, I think, neocon warmongers all. So she says, if anti-ISIL fighters take Manbij and then Jarablus, this will sever the ISIL link to Turkey, which is their supply line. Without this, they are doomed. They will wither on the vine. This is like encirclements and cutting the enemy supply line. Quote, recapturing Manbij and ultimately advancing to Jarablus would disrupt but not totally eliminate ISIS's ability to resupply. Well, there might be a trickle, but this is the lion's share. The U.S.-led coalition has long had its eye on the so-called Manbij pocket. But an offensive on this mainly Arab region has run into opposition from Turkey, a key partner in the alliance. And we know what this is. Erdogan is the head of ISIS. Turkey is massively betraying the allies, including the United States, by giving support, material, concrete support of all kinds, political, diplomatic, logistical, military, bombardment, direct intervention. It's all coming from Turkey in favor of ISIS. So the U.S., of course, views the YPG as the most effective ground forces. And there are, however, enough Arabs in the attack so that it may not be seen as simply a sectarian exercise. Now, here we're told also the SDF has 15 armed factions and all the rest. So you have a map here on Al Jazeera, and you can see Aleppo, and you can see Manbij, and Manbij is definitely in the corridor. It's on the west side of the Euphrates River. So last week, you'll remember, we had these pictures of U.S. forces wearing YPG patches on their uniforms, and of course, Erdogan and company freaked out because their lunatic claim is that all Kurds are terrorists. This is ridiculous. This covers the fact that Erdogan is the commander of ISIS. He's been in bed with ISIS. He's the real caliph. That guy Baghdadi is just a placeholder, a stand-in. U.S. is still helping the Kurdish fighters, right? So over the past 10 days, the SDF YPG has also launched an offensive to retake Raqqa, the main ISIL hold in Syria. That's their capital. Let's tell the whole truth. That's what Erdogan is trying to protect. And I think you've also got to point out that a lot of this screaming about humanitarian stuff are veiled attempts to try to do something to stop the attack on Manbij. So here we have a whole bunch of stuff in Al Jazeera. So this is, and with this, we're only at the halfway mark, right? We've been talking about the offensive on Raqqa, which was already evident last week. On Monday, we began to get these reports of an attack on Manbij. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley speaking to you from Washington, D.C. Now, we're only about halfway through our account of the four-pronged assault on the ISIS butchers, which is now unfolding with everybody pitching in, right? The Iranian forces, the U.S., the Shiite militias, the Kurds, and others all attacking ISIS. And this right now is what you want. And I have to point out, let's just jump ahead to the political analysis. The reason this is so important is that if ISIS is destroyed, it is very likely that the fascist Trump will lose the November election. Because, of course, the anti-American running down the country, whining, carping, anti-national. He's a nationalist. He's an anti-nationalist. All of that depends on defeat. Trump needs defeat, humiliation, like he needs air to breathe. If ISIS is destroyed or reduced to a bunch of fugitives going across the desert sands, then that is curtains for Trump. Every victory is another nail in the coffin of Trump's political plan to seize power in the name of fascism here in Washington, D.C. The psychotic fascist or fascist psycho, you can take your pick, will be discomfited if he has nothing to complain about. And we'll even talk about some terror incidents that might also fit into this picture. But this is the idea. The strategy for this campaigning season, the summer, essentially in the Middle East, before those Mediterranean winter rains begin to come in, especially along the coast, is bury Trump under an avalanche of victories. American victory, American success is poison for Trump. And with that, we will have steered away, at least for the moment, from the edge of the abyss where Trump has now dragged us with his fascist demagogic campaign, which depends on the craven, despicable cowardice and stupidity of Republican hack leaders like Paul Ryan. But let's get back to the Middle East. So we have the Kurdish forces getting quite close to Raqqa, and that could turn into a coup de main, depending on how much the ISIS butchers have concentrated their forces there. And then we have this question of Manbij, and in the previous segment we went through this. Now, if you take a look at the map, just put in Manbij, M-A-N-B-I-J, you will see, first of all, the line along the border that goes from Jarablus over to practically Azaz. That is the portal through which everything has to come. But, of course, there are roads involved here. And the big road is Highway 216, which comes down from the Jarablus. Here it's Jarablus. In the article, it was Jarablus. 2016, it's the same thing. That road comes down to Manbij. Manbij also controls the principal east-west highway, which is the M4. So Manbij is the intersection of Highway 216 coming from the north, going south, more or less along the west bank of the Euphrates. But this is, once this is gone, if this can be cut, then there's only one other road that can be used, and that is the one that goes from Al-Rai to Al-Bab. Al-Bab, I think, is the gate, but let's see. So you get the idea. It is the process of inexorably strangling the terrorist enemies, cutting their supply line, and then they fall apart. Then they will not be able to maintain their military operations. And by the way, that goes for a whole lot of other terrorists, right? Not just the ones that cavort, do their crimes under the leadership of the ISIS people, right? Essentially of Erdogan. Now, Fallujah, here the siege also started last Monday, rather quick. And there again, you've got General Soleimani of the Revolutionary Guards. There are also preparations being made for an attack on Mosul. Now, Mosul, of course, is the jewel in the crown of ISIS. Their most valuable property, certainly. They have been under ISIS rule in Mosul for 2 years. You remember it was the summer of 2012, just around this time, that Saudi money was used to bribe the officers of the Iraqi army and make them run away. And at that point, of course, the Iraqi army, like just about any army, fell apart and also fled. So you've got also Iranian forces are in action there. And there's also an attempt to manage the role given to Shiite militias, because they have been known to overdo it when they get into these Sunni towns, where it's clear that a lot of people have been collaborating with ISIS, because that's what they did. But still, you want to observe the Geneva Convention and not allow that. Now, if you put this together, you see that this is a powerful pattern. This is extremely ominous for ISIS, for Erdogan, and for Trump. France 24 today, in their coverage, talked about this pattern as the turn of the tide, a possible turn of the tide. In other words, the beginning of the end for ISIS. Ideally, we would like to see ISIS either totally smashed or reeling and retreating and collapsing on all fronts by Labor Day. That is, by the American holiday in the first week of September. October 1st would be the latest you'd want to have this, right? Because you want the political effects to be fully appreciated. We've also reminded that Obama has made some statements saying that he would regard the defeat of ISIS as a crowning achievement of his presidential term in office. So I can only say, bring it on. I mean, you can think about this as restitution, reparations. Not so much Obama not ordering it, but not firing the Petraeus Allen cliquists, the defeatists and pro-terrorists and the pro-Erdogan people. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, Washington, D.C. So we are looking, and we have been giving you harbingers of this all last week, really. We're looking at a four-pronged U.S., Kurdish, plus Iranian attack on the butchers of the Islamic State, right? The genocidal maniacs that simply are incorrigible and therefore must be eliminated. And these people, and not carpet bombed, right? Trump has talked about, if you listen to Trump, he seems to be suggesting that a tactical nuclear weapon would be the right approach to Raqqa. This is ridiculous. It's not a nuclear target or carpet bombing or things like this. This is all obviously bravado, the stuff he's looked at in Rambo movies and other sources where he gets his impoverished outlook of scraps and patches of ideas and shreds of concepts for his psychotic mind. So the people of Raqqa, now Mosul is a couple of million people, right? So that's got to be liberated, and that's what this is all up to, right? The liberation of Raqqa, Manjib, and that's, sorry, Manbij. And with Manbij, it's this question of the logistics. Fallujah, which is surrounded now, and Mosul, where the first preparations for siege and attack are being made. Also notice that Sinjar, another important town in that same area, was taken last Armistice Day, right? Last November 11th. So it is possible to take out some of these ISIS garrisons in short order. And again, every victory is another nail in the political coffin of the fascist billionaire Donald Trump. So, Obama, if you want to have a legacy, you have to appeal to him somehow, right? I've been appealing on the basis of national interest and all that. But maybe we have a more powerful tool in personal interest, as unfortunately often happens. Anyway, in this world, if somebody's doing the right thing for the wrong reason, you're going to take it, because that, in many cases, is the absolute best you're ever going to get. There's also this interesting phenomenon of the vote in the German parliament, the Bundestag, on declaring the Armenian massacres of the World War I era as a form of genocide. And the Turks are obviously up in arms about this, right? And I am certainly not an expert on this historical stuff. All I can say is, with the Turks under Erdogan supporting ISIS, which is a genocidal agency par excellence, I don't see how they have a leg to stand on in arguing that they didn't commit genocide 100 years ago. So what it does is it fits in to the pattern, right, that the noose is closing around Erdogan. I would say to people in the NATO command, how long are you going to put up with this guy, Erdogan? And how long are you going to put up with that kind of terrorism? Your whole human rights argument has collapsed because of the way that Erdogan carries on, you know, muzzles, jails the opposition, special attention for women, horrible, horrible stuff, right? Erdogan should be replaced by a democratic government. So maybe there are ways to facilitate that process. So we should probably proceed on now to the questions of internal domestic U.S. Politics. First of all, we want to congratulate the very energetic and very capable members of the Tax Wall Street Party out there in California, in the San Jose, I guess that's San Francisco area, and also in the area south of San Diego, who have been intervening and doing just a wonderful job. You notice that these anti-Trump demonstrations have some spirit, but their political line is just terrible. It's not effective. It's written by some foundation-funded foundation operative. So what we do is go in there with this obvious point, Trump equals Nazi, with the face of Trump, and inject powerful and highly relevant political content. We probably ought to talk about the question of fascism as we've been able to raise it just this past week. But let's look at some of this stuff. You'll remember that the Tax Wall Street Party approach is let evil fight evil. We wish to encourage different factions which represent evil in their own ideology or practice. We want to see them fighting each other. We don't want the factions of evil being able to gang up on the American people or anybody else. We want them to cancel each other out. Now, in the course of this past week, I think this was a very bad week for Trump. And you have to remember that all of those generalizations about how Trump's wild and violent, bombastic rhetoric, we have all kinds of people on television saying that has not hurt him. Yeah, wait, Trump up to now has been functioning in the atmosphere of a Republican primary. And the Republican primary voter, of course, is by definition a lunatic. How, otherwise he wouldn't, she wouldn't be, they wouldn't be Republican primary voters. So what we've seen, I think, is that, the opposition to Trump has been studying things like, well, let's say my, slideshow in the, late afternoon of, Saturday, May 21st, and you can see this on Tarpley.net under a couple of days after that, that Trump is mentally disturbed. Trump is mentally ill. Trump may indeed be suffering from Alzheimer's disease, which killed his father. He may have, therefore, dementia, senility. He is 70 years old. He is out of control. Hypothesis number two is the obsessive compulsive disorder. This one is relevant because Trump claims he has it. Trump says, essentially, he admits, confesses that he's got what he calls borderline obsessive compulsive disorder. Now, he may have mixed up borderline personality disorder, which is a story of its own, with obsessive compulsive disorder, or this may be a limited hangout, but this is the one that Howard Hughes had. This is why he doesn't want to shake hands. He's afraid of germs. He doesn't like teachers. Another hypothesis that we talked about in New York City on the 21st of May was narcissism, and indeed extreme narcissism in the sense of megalomania. He once he has the main prerequisite for narcissism, which is no father, an absent father. After punching a teacher at his private school, little Donald, who had been fighting and was a conduct deportment disaster, was sent away to a brutal military school, the New York Military Academy, grades 8 through 12, where he was brutally beaten by some of his coaches. And I think we can say, this is full-blown narcissistic personality disorder. As Freud said, people of this type impress others as being personalities, glamorous. So, Trump is a personality cult. So, playing on this, you can actually take the initiative away from him, get his goat, and get under his skin. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C., broadcasting on the afternoon of June 3rd, 2016. Now, we were just mentioning that in that appearance, the Tax Wall Street Party seminars that were held in the Left Forum, we talked about the possibility that Trump has the dementia and Alzheimer's disease, senility in that form. That's what killed his father. Perfectly feasible. Obsessive compulsive disorder has certain authority because he says that's what he has. Now, that means that he's been seen by a shrink. We want to see the report from that psychiatrist. You're not getting your little stubby fingers on the nuclear button if you don't come up with that report and your entire medical records. You see, we've now opened up a new front on Trump, not just his tax returns, which we demand to see because we think that he's a con man who pretends to be rich in order to impress the Mickeys. We don't think he's that rich at all. We think he's probably, he may have negative net worth for all we know, right, with the things that have been going on. And of course, we want to see the entire medical file, including the mental health file. Who told you that you have borderline obsessive compulsive disorder? Well, then there's also narcissism and megalomania. That seems to be absolutely central. That seems to be what makes him need to denigrate and insult people, to disparage them in all different ways. And also this hysterical necessity that he seems to feel to assert that he is right, or that his viewpoint is the only possible one. Notice also this fear and hatred of women. Hatred of women equals fear of women he seems to have been a child out of the studies of Melanie Klein, the rage against the mother. That seems to be Trump. So he is out there at the border of neurosis and psychosis or beyond. And remember, narcissism grows out of lack of empathy from the parents. The Trump hypothesis number four, manic depressive bipolar with borderline personality disorder. That was suggested by CNN back in April 2011. Does he have these cycles? Fifth hypothesis, sadism. Does Trump have sadistic personality disorder, right? You're fired. Let's murder the families of the terrorists. Let's destroy whole villages. Essentially torment the weakest and most defenseless. Number six, histrionic personality disorder with infantile regression. He could fill the bill for that. Number seven, multiple personality disorder. Remember, he calls people up as John Miller. He pretends to be his own public relations man, and this runs in the family. The father, Fred Trump, did dirty deals calling himself Mr. Green. Mad cow disease, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease from eating low-grade Trump steaks infected with bovine spongiform encephalopathy. Number nine, alcoholic codependence. When you have a family that produces an alcoholic, like his late brother, Fred J. Trump Jr., then this entire family is thought to be afflicted by certain distortions and disorders. And, of course, then number 10, his own personal Vietnam, which was his attempt to avoid venereal disease, sexually transmitted diseases, HIV, AIDS, what have you. Well, some of his measures are coherent with long-term syphilis. And if you think that's impossible, remember that the president of the United States, Ronald Reagan, went his whole first term in office without getting a colonoscopy, which he finally did, and they discovered actual malignant tissue there in his intestine. So here's the idea, though. You've got to learn how to bait Trump. You've got to learn how to get his goat. What kinds of tactics work? With this, you can tie him up in knots. You can increase his stress. Get under his skin. Everybody says this. Get his goat. I prefer that one. But you get the idea. So on Tuesday, we had a press conference by Trump, which was actually a psychotic episode. He acted out a psychotic episode in front of the press. He told the guy Yamas from ABC that he was a sleaze. He told Jim Acosta of CNN that he was a real beauty. Again, we delight to see evil fighting evil. We want evil to fight evil even more. There's going to be less evil in the world when the dust settles after all this, right? We're not defending people against Trump's attacks. We're simply saying Trump could be the vehicle for a fascist coup d'etat here in the United States, which these little reporters certainly cannot manage. They know. Seizure, I would say, right, where he, you know, foamed at the mouth. Hitler was known to chew the carpet. I wonder, at some point it might be appropriate to send Trump these carpet samples with a dotted line. And, of course, the instruction says, chew a long dotted line. This is the so-called Teppichfresser line on Hitler from around Munich, 1938. Okay, so there you see it. I mean, this person should not be allowed to run for office. He should be in a place of therapeutic confinement. He ought to be committed. He ought to have a canvas blazer. He ought to have a padded cell. Why doesn't his wife get him committed? Because otherwise he may be a threat to himself and to others. And, of course, he may be headed for a nervous breakdown well before the end of this process. And then on Thursday, we had this attack by Hillary Clinton, which, of course, scored quite a few points, that he is bizarre, unfit for office, that he rants, that he feuds, that you don't want the launch codes in his hands. I think this is an important one. As in the case of Lyndon B. Johnson against Goldwater in 1964, you remember that there were a couple of things going on there. Then there was the girl picking the petals off a flower, at which point that became a countdown through a thermonuclear detonation that scared a lot of people. And Goldwater's intemperate rhetoric that he wanted the east coast of the United States to go off into the ocean and sink. And if you saw that, that was pretty chilling for the 150-odd million people who would have been underwater at that point, literally underwater. So don't let him get his fingers on the launch code. He's too unstable. It could be because somebody has gotten under his gossamer-thin skin. How could you have a madman like this in the Situation Room deciding these great questions? And don't tell me that we've already had it with George W. Bush, of course. But that doesn't mean you want to go back again. And I think one of the interesting points in Hillary's speech, she says, we have to ask his psychiatrist why he is so fascinated with authoritarian rulers. I would say it is important to respect the status quo. The status quo is better than anything offered in place of it. That applies to Trump, most obviously. Now, Mrs. Clinton, of course, is of course a disaster in foreign policy. Bernie Sanders has mustered the ability to challenge Mrs. Clinton on her vote in favor of the Iraq War. Very serious. More serious, I would think, because of the kind of executive role she has as Secretary of State, is Libya, because all the accounts, be it the New York Times account or the Washington Post account, agree that most of the senior officials there were against bombing Libya. They were against the regime change operation against Colonel Gaddafi, which is now turned into this failed state and a monstrous situation. So she's evil, of course. But what we've now got finally, God, thank God, evil is fighting evil. And this means that the good will ultimately, I think, benefit. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome to the second hour of World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Now, the general outline, therefore, is clear, right? If you want to get Trump's goat, you seize the initiative because you essentially turn him into a geek act. In other words, he has to act out, right? It's like if you say Niagara Falls, then Trump will say, slowly I turned, and he's out of control. He can't prevent himself from doing these things. So generally, his business ventures, obviously his sleazy fraud of Trump University, Trump Steaks, Trump Airlines, his bankruptcies, which he denies, lying, not a personal bankruptcy, but business, his businesses have been bankrupt, and my own personal contribution. You'll remember that back at the time of Thanksgiving 1990, when Citibank had been seized surreptitiously, silently, by federal regulators, Trump got a sweetheart deal. He was allowed to keep a lot of the property that he should have been stripped of. So that means that the then George H.W. Bush administration and Secretary of the Treasury Nicholas Brady considered Trump to be some kind of a VIP, an insider. Get it? Libertarians, even the dumbest libertarian should be able to figure that out. All right, so you've got to get his goat. And you got to find ways to keep getting his goat. It's been noted all around, right? That Tuesday press conference, which was about had he really given the money to the veterans organizations, he could have stood there like a prince saying, yes, I got $6 million. And sorry I was a little bit late, but here it is. You know how it is. I've been running for president. Big job. No. He's got to go with... Yamas is a sleaze, and Acosta is a real beauty, and the press are horrible. And, of course, they are horrible, but we want evil to fight evil. We're not choosing sides. We're trying to get in the middle and exacerbate the conflict so the maximum destruction of evil is actually accomplished. Now, a couple of things here. Third-party candidacies. I'll say something about Jill Stein in a minute. I think Jill Stein is a pretty wretched enterprise that Jill Stein has going. But now the Gary Johnson and William Weld ticket. Here's what we hear about this. Gary Johnson, of course, a Republican retread, a Republican hack, now principally a libertarian stoner, of course, lots of narcotics. This is, of course, a party of national decline, in the same way that the Republicans are the party of national sabotage. But now, William Weld, what is William Weld doing there? William Weld is a Boston Brahmin. He is an oligarch. He's an active member of the U.S. Old money ruling class oligarchy. When you look at Weld, you have to remember that that was White Weld Securities, which has been eaten up by some other larger fish in Wall Street. But that's like Howard Dean is from Dean Witter. Well, William Weld is from White Weld. And you got to remember that once an oligarch, not so easy to go straight after that. It's generally figured the Democrats begin with 270 electoral votes. The Democrat will then build on that. But the interesting speculation from NPR this morning is that it's possible that Gary Johnson and William Weld could carry Utah. And the way that would work, of course, is that the Latter-day Saints, right, the Mormon Church, for reasons of their own, and they may not be good, I don't think they are, but they hate Trump, and that is most welcome. Remember, Trump lost Utah by a mile. The reason that Glenn Beck is so vehement against Trump is that that's the official Mormon position. So if you could get the Johnson-Weld ticket to take the electoral votes of Utah, that would mean there would be some possibility, maybe, that neither candidate would get it. I think that part is rather fanciful. But if it ever got to the House of Representatives, you remember that the way it works in the House of Representatives is that each state gets one vote. And since the Republicans controlled most state delegations, the Republican would win. And who would be the Republican at that point? I don't think it would be Trump. I think it would be these two Republican hack retreads, Gary Johnson and William Weld. William Weld from the Justice Department. He's a police state type. And then liberal Republican governor of Massachusetts. Those guys might conceivably have a chance. So you might say that the Republican establishment is covering itself, right? If you could get into the House of Representatives, these people would become really important. The only way you get into the House of Representatives, though, is if you score some vote, one, two, whatever it is, in the House of Representatives. Ryan, we'll talk about Ryan comparing to various people of the Nazi era in a minute. Let's see. We probably need to... we certainly have to compliment the Tax Wall Street activists. They've been extremely active. Remember, we had one at Lawrenceville, New Jersey, 10 days ago. Then we had south of San Diego. We had one in the Los Angeles area. We were there last couple of days. And just in the last 72 hours or so, we were there in San Jose. And I would, given the hysteria of the libertarians about this stuff, our representatives in San Jose report from the San Jose Convention Center that the police lined up in the late afternoon with no riot gear, right? They were not expecting any trouble, but that at about 6:30 p.m., the cops suddenly, not responding to some event that you could see, but responding apparently to some order that came down, the cops donned their riot gear, and at that point, there was a barrage of tweets on Twitter, obviously, saying that violence was going on. But apparently, there was no violence to be seen. So the people that were there then were all herded to the next railway station, the local commuter rail transit, Bay Area, I guess. They were pushed in there. Those trains were suspended, and they had to go home I think on buses. So the point about this was that somehow this violence, if that's what you want to call it, was orchestrated. Anyway, here's my general feeling. The lesson of fascism is that it has to be fought. It has to be staunchly opposed. And you cannot expect free Americans, civilized people, to simply let some fascist demagogue like Trump come into their community and take over. No, they're not going to do that. There are going to be militant demonstrations, okay? Militant. I'm astounded. People who have now qualified pretty much as fascists, they're always whining, right? The goal of the fascist of yesteryear was to be a tough guy. Today, they seem to have forgotten about this, right? These are degenerates even as fascists because they're always whining. They're talking about social justice warriors and how they're mean and all the rest of this. That's absolutely ridiculous. So I think it's actually a healthy sign if there are militant demonstrations against Trump. Now, obviously, some of the stuff that's being done is it smacks of that foundation-funded pseudo organizations. But still, they're still doing something about Trump. Also, you look at some of these things, right? The people that the Trumpists send out. In one case, we've got this old, drunk, and elderly psychotic at the free speech event in Irvine, California. What the heck is that? We've also got this guy, Milo Yiannopoulos, who seems now to be the hero of the libertarians. Boy, they went from von Hayek and von Mises to Milo Yiannopoulos of Breitbart. Boy, what a fall. So all kinds of dubious elements circulating. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Now, an extraordinary series of events, really, which we're very proud of. Back on Saturday, May 21st, we had the big day of the Left Forum here in New York City, and the Tax Wall Street Party took part. You will have seen we had one on COINTELPRO, one on the destruction and extinction of the Republican Party. We had one about Trump as fascist, Nazi, if you want, and psychotic. And then on the following day, we had one about the greatness of Alexander Hamilton and the wretched nature of Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson, who are his enemy and posthumous enemy. So, interestingly enough, by the time you get to the 29th of May, so 8 days after the Left Forum, we have the New York Times on May 29th printing a discussion of the right-wing, xenophobic, and indeed fascistic movements in the West, right, meaning Europe and the United States and maybe Canada. That would be the Western world. So that's, I think, a very, very interesting thing. In other words, precisely the issue that we were raising. And our point was, if you want to fight Trump, you must call him by the scientifically precise, accurate, historically valid name. He is a fascist. In his more extreme moments, of course, he's a Nazi. So you might as well consider him a Nazi too. These, by the way, are not fundamentally different. They're in the same continuum or simply the same, if you want it, right? Simplify matters. Don't worry about that. A lot of people are quibbling, right? They say, oh my heavens, these are nominalists. These are experts in semantics, not action. They're more worried about misapplying an epithet than they are about having a fascist seizure of power and World War III and genocide. That doesn't get them going. But the abuse of terminology, and this is no abuse, right? They're doing the abuse because they're hiding from the average person the responsibility that they have is to denounce fascism when it comes along, and that's what they ought to be able to do, but they can't do it. Because they are nominalists, academics, they are impotent politically in that sense. It's interesting that in this article, we have Newt Gingrich really freaked out about being called a fascist or having Trump, and then by implication him. Newt Gingrich says he's deeply offended by utterly ignorant comparisons. Trump does not have a political structure in the sense that the fascists did. What does that mean? Does he have armed gangs? Does he have hooligans? Does he want to deport 12 million people and kill a good number in the process? He's a one-time college professor, doctorate in modern European history. He doesn't have the sort of ideology they did. Looks to me like he does. That's exactly what he has. He has nobody who resembles the brown shirts. This is all just garbage. I challenge you, Newt Gingrich, to a debate anytime. All right, so this discussion was on the 29th of May. Then on June 1st, Diane Rehm Show, National Public Radio. The title is The Rise of Far-Right Political Movements in the West. And here we have the interesting Robert Paxton, right? Paxton, along with Stanley Payne, and along with people who are actually pro-fascists, De Felice or Noll. Yeah. And Soucy, Robert Soucy, write about fascism, including the French variety. So Paxton has a couple of interesting points. He's very tied up with this thing about the terminology, right? That fascism is used as a kind of all-purpose abuse. That's not what we're doing. We waited a long time. You notice we did not call Bush a fascist in that sense. We, at least we pointed out that he did not have a fascist mass movement. So here's what Paxton says. Mr. Trump, whether knowingly or simply by some kind of instinct, is using language and even facial gestures that recall those of Hitler and Mussolini. Yes, that's true. I've been saying this for a long time, that Trump is watching the Mussolini newsreels, and he's learning how to make faces, to grimace, to scowl, to stick his jutting chin out, and all the rest of it. He plays on the theme of decline, right? Crippled America. We're losing everything. Anti-Americanism. And he has all these apocalyptic scenarios. Then, the arrival by plane, right? This is the triumph of the will. The Leni Riefenstahl movie, among others, about Hitler, Hitler is late for a big rally, so he lands and he goes there in this tremendous atmosphere of excitement. And this is exactly Trump. The notion that Paxton has is that various ethnic groups are being scapegoated because of the inability of certain individuals and groups to keep up with globalization. Well, of course, we are opposed to globalization, and this is where we would say that some of the beefs, some of the complaints, the malaise of white workers and even the white petty bourgeoisie, some of this is perfectly justified. In other words, just because a fascist abuses an issue doesn't mean that it's not an issue. Remember also, as I've argued over quite a while, we have this idea of fascist pageantry, emblems, marches, meetings, visual symbols, liturgical rituals. The goal was to envelop the participant in a mystique and community of ritual that appealed to the aesthetic and the spiritual sense as well as the political. Well, I don't know about aesthetic, but that thing where you have the ritual reading of the polls, the ritual insult of whoever it is, whatever bourgeois politician he's targeting at that point, the ritual beating up of some protester that Trump singles out and urges on. In other words, it's a very stylized performance that he's gotten in today with the and then of course the evocation of the wall and the attack on Muslims, if he's got any in the room. So the problem though with Paxton, as I write, you can look at this in the daily briefing, Paxton is so afraid of using the wrong word, right? If he committed an error of dating in the history of Francisco Franco in his relations with Vichy France, he's going to die of shame, right? Whereas you ought to be considering, what do you owe the American people. You've got to be an organic intellectual of this people. They need it. And that's what I try to do. So that's the difference between action and academia. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Topley here. And you got to go to Topley.net, Topley.net. Follow everything there. You get World Crisis Radio there. You get the daily briefing there. If you need a anti-Trump poster, you can download this wonderful pair of posters that we have to use, right? Here, the libertarians are freaking out because somebody says if Trump comes to your town, you should do a protest. Well, that's exactly right. So if you want to have a politically accurate and effective protest, you better pull down those Trump equals Nazi posters from the Topley.net website. Now, let's look a little bit more at this guy Paxton, because he, in spite of his being so tongue-tied and tied up in essentially nominalism and pedantry, let's take a look at some of the things that he's written. Now, the interesting thing about him is that he has divided the life cycle of fascist movements into five phases, right? Five stages. And let's see if we can find these. So we just tick them off. Here we go. First phase, intellectual exploration, where disillusionment with democracy manifests itself as a lost national vigor. Well, those are the libertarians, right? That's von Hayek, von Mises. That's the libertarian movement. That's Lou Rockwell and these people, right? Anti-American, obviously. Anti-American from a mile away. Anti-democratic. Claiming to love the Constitution, in reality, getting ready to shred it. Okay, so we've gone beyond that, though. Most of those libertarians have now flipped into the lap of Trump, the fascist. Secondly is the phase of rooting. Now, it means taking root, where a fascist movement aided by political deadlock, that would be the logjam in the Congress, right? Partisan gridlock, not deadlock. We have gridlock. And polarization becomes a player on the national stage. Well, that was already Ron Paul. And we've got Trump. Now, here's the other one. Arrival to power, taking power, seizing power, where conservatives, I wouldn't call them conservatives, as you know, they are reactionaries. So taking power, and in this process, reactionaries seek to control a rising radical opposition. He says leftist. I wouldn't say that. Radical opposition. They invite the fascist movement to share power. And after that comes fourth phase, exercise of power. The movement and its charismatic leader control the state in some kind of uneasy balance with the state institutions, the police, the traditional elites, clergy, business magnates, and so forth. And then five, radicalization or entropy. Here you can become increasingly radical. That's the Hitler model. Or you kind of calm down and you become a traditional dictatorship, fascist Italy, okay? But notice, the intellectual phase is one, taking root, in other words, establishing yourself, right? Getting on the political map. Two, and then taking power. Now, we should just remind ourselves here of this question, which Paxton is interested in, and this has drawn my attention there, too, over the last couple of days, right, since we had the New York Times article and the NPR discussion. Who were the bourgeois politicians that were around Hitler and who, in one way or another, essentially invited him to take power? Well, President von Hindenburg, right, the military hero of World War One, right, the Eastern Front, Battle of Tannenberg, all that. So we had Hindenburg and we had Ludendorff. Ludendorff had been present at Hitler's beer hall putsch in 1923, very important guy. Hindenburg, called Hitler to become the chancellor. So that's very bad. We also have these other people, Von Papen, P-A-P-E-N. He had been the chancellor just before Hitler, or one chancellor ahead of Hitler. This was in the summer of 1932. And Von Papen was representative of the nobility, feudal nobility, aristocrat. And his line was, we can control Hitler. We'll control his advisors and we'll get Hitler to do what we want. Schleicher is a military man. He's more interesting because he actually had a strategic concept. He said, I will split the Nazi movement between the crazy people around Hitler in Munich and the Brown House, and on the other hand, the Strasser brothers, right? Gregor Strasser and so forth, who are essentially based in the Ruhr area, right, in Germany. So there's also this guy Hugenberg, right, one of the biggest losers. Hugenberg had been a really important guy, the head of Krupp, this huge steel armaments cannon company. But then he became the head of the Deutsche Nationale Volkspartei, the German National People's Party, and that was the East Elbe and Junkers. And it was those with the Latifundists, the huge estates to the east of the Elbe River, going out there into Pomerania and Silesia and Prussia and East Prussia, all the way out. So this Hugenberg had joined in, he was a political ally. Hugenberg and von Papen, that I just mentioned, these were political allies. But they created the Harzburg Front. So in the summer of 1931, it's Hugenberg and his Latifundist party plus Stahlhelm, right? Stahlhelm, that's a veterans group, the Association of Frontline Soldiers, veterans, right? Stormtroopers. And that's October 1931. But essentially what happens is that Hitler eats Hugenberg's lunch. And there is this very interesting horse trading. And I was just reminded of this because of current events. In the 1932 election for president of the German Republic, and this was directly elected by popular vote. In the 1932 presidential election, you have von Hindenburg running with the support of the Social Democrats, who were so frightened by Hitler. You have Hitler running, and Hugenberg says, I'm going to have my own candidate. Now, this is interesting. I'm thinking of William Kristol today. William Kristol says, oh, my God, I can't allow Trump to win. I've got to deploy a third candidate who will siphon votes away from Trump and therefore make sure he loses. This is what Hugenberg did. And in particular, he recruited a guy called Theodor Dusterberg. Theodor Dusterberg or Dusterberg. And he says, hey, you should run for president. And Dusterberg does, and then there are scandals, and we don't need to go into all the scandals. But the idea, some of these people, I think, don't know that they are acting out and repeating things that have already happened under similar circumstances in the earlier fascist era. This is the huge problem, right? They do it, but they don't know it. Problem is that people have lost touch with this era, and they've lost touch with the lessons of the era. So you should listen to me, because I have not lost touch. I know what I'm talking about. If I tell you that Trump fulfills the fascist minimum 10, 12 points from the stab in the back to the triumph of the will, take it seriously. I know what I'm talking about. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. So to sum up that last point, I know these things are obscure. In the same way that Hugenberg of Krupp, of the German National People's Party, and of this Harzburg Front, he went out and recruited Dusterberg to be a candidate against Hindenburg and Hitler, with the idea that he would take votes away from Hitler. And that may have succeeded, because Hitler lost that election. So That doesn't mean this was a failure. It might have been a success. This is the same as William Crystal going and recruiting the little-known David French of the Weekly Standard to go out and campaign. Now, some other things from Paxton. This is once again the article on the five stages of fascism. Now, what's the origin of modern fascism? This will surprise some. This is Paxton. I think this is very intriguing. He says, we have to go back further in American history. Now, notice, he says, America and France as the two republics, the constitutional republics, these are the countries where the disappointment with democracy is going to show up earlier. And that's where the fascist movements are going to be visible, except they're not going to win in the United States, certainly, and not in France until the Nazi army comes. But it's in other countries which are not so democratic where the fascists not only originate, but because the earliest phenomenon that seems functionally related to fascism, the Ku Klux Klan, just after the Civil War, some former Confederate officers, right? Nathan Bedford Forrest, war criminal, and Albert Pike, Freemasonic war criminal, statue behind the Labor Department here in Washington, right? With all of those Confederates are going to be taken down, which I support, take down this Albert Pike statue. This is a monstrosity, an eyesore. So just after the Civil War, these Confederates, fearing the vote given to African Americans by radical Reconstruction in 1867, set up a militia, that is a fascist gang, armed, terroristic, to restore and overturn social order. The Klan constituted an alternate civic authority parallel to the legal state, which in its founders' eyes no longer defended their community's legitimate interests. It has a uniform, the white robe and the white hood, right? What Scalia was found with, as well as its techniques of intimidation and its conviction that violence was justified in the cause of the group's destiny. In other words, white Southern latifundists. The first version of the Klan in the defeated American South, right, because it comes from defeated Germany, defeated Italy, and so forth, halfway defeated Italy. It's a remarkable preview of the way fascist movements were to function in interwar Europe. So it comes from the late 1860s in the American South. Now, let's just look at how we want to focus precisely in the phase we are right now, where the fascists, Trump or Mussolini or Hitler, where they get these alliances with the so-called conservatives, in reality, of course, reactionaries, right? How is it that the reactionaries help the fascists to come to power? Well, sometimes they're frightened. Sometimes they're opportunistic. But what you do find is that the resistance of these reactionaries is minimal, minimal. Remember when Mussolini is approaching, well, he's not even there, right? When his stand-ins are taking the march on Rome towards Rome in October 1922, General Badoglio says to the king, 5 minutes of gunfire and fascism will be gone, finished, kaput. Oh, no, says the king. We want to give him the ability to form a government. Right. So same thing with Hitler. If Hindenburg had hung tough, Hitler could never have formed the government. It's often thought that the Hindenburg story was because of the gambling debts of his son, also an officer, Oskar von Hindenburg, was a ne'er-do-well and very embarrassing to his august father. And somehow the cover-up of that was linked to calling in Hitler to create the government. Notice also, fascists, what you see with Trump is actually typical of fascists in the sense that they're constantly throwing their ideological positions overboard. In other words, you have a group of people who are stuck in the first highly ideological, highly radicalized phase of fascist development. By the time you get to the contending for power and then the third phase, seizing power, the leaders want to throw the ideological points overboard as fast as they possibly can. So it's at this point that you see these purges, right? In other words, the Night of the Long Knives. Trump has been doing this on the installment plan, right? He brings in Manafort. He brings in even Roger Stone. He brings in Mnuchin. He brings in all the rest of these people. And it means that the original, you know, as Manafort even says, right, what he says is essentially just a patter, right? It has no validity. So the role, and of course what we're talking about today is Paul Ryan, right? So here we have Paul Ryan, this wonderful man of principle. Of course, he's a genocidalist. He wants to strip you of your economic rights. He wants to take away your Medicare, your Medicaid, your Social Security, your unemployment benefits. All of that is communist. It violates the free market as expressed by the supply-siders. And we've got the supply-siders, Stephen Moore and Larry Kudlow in there advising Trump from their point of view. The one thing that I wanted to mention, I should have mentioned in the context of the Ku Klux Klan, if the Ku Klux Klan is the original matrix of modern fascism, which I think is very, very likely, and then you can say similar groups in the defeated France of the 1870s, in other words, after the Franco-Prussian War, after the fall of Napoleon the third, you're going to begin to get these, you know, these Alsace-Lorraine crazies, right? It's the thing that people understand with Maurice Barrès, Deroulède, all these people, essentially fascists or proto-fascists, whatever you like. But why is Donald Trump such a great friend of Senator Jeff Sessions? Why so much power for Senator Sessions? Because that's the Scottish Rite Freemasons. Those are the Confederates, right? And that Trump realizes that his entire southern wing, right? Trump's situation is completely hopeless. I think it's hopeless anyway. But it's if Trump can keep his footing in these southern states, right, and try to hold on to Virginia and North Carolina and Georgia and places like this, then that's the only hope he has of even getting anywhere. Which again, I think is not likely. So what you see then is a bunch of opportunistic politicians, right? Think Ryan, think Newt Gingrich, right, who is obviously a candidate for the vice presidency. Look at Senator Corker of Tennessee. Can you imagine Senator Corker of Tennessee back when Trump had his demagogic foreign policy speech at the Mayflower Hotel, and Senator Corker comes out and says, oh, this is one of the greatest foreign policy speeches I've ever heard. Well, this is absolutely nonsensical. Now, just one last thing. At the Left Forum, what did we have? We had, as I think I said last week, Chris Hedges. Is this guy, he doesn't give you a straight answer, right? He gives you references to books, references to Yugoslavia. It's clear that Hedges can't figure out that there's one big difference between Hillary Clinton and Trump. Trump has a fascist mass movement and Hillary doesn't. Jill Stein wants you to be asleep when Trump comes in the night because she wants you to vote for her and not for Hillary. And I'm afraid Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report, his line, I ain't afraid of no Trump, that will not do, because this is a very, very serious thing. Famous last words, I ain't afraid of no Trump. No nightmare in brown shirts. Maybe not brown shirts, but Trump, that's bad enough. Nightmare in...